This is James Woodcock's podcast, episode 35, recorded 1st of November 2012. Trilobite Games. Hello, I am James Woodcock from jameswoodcock.co.uk, and today over Skype I have with me Trilobite Games, who are responsible for revolutionary classic titles including The Seventh Guest, The Eleventh Hour, and many more besides, which we will cover today. Joining me are Rob Landros, who is the co-founder and creative director for Trilobite Games.
Hello, this is Rob.
Thank you, James. Nice to be here with you.
Hello, Rob. And Aftermath Media co-founder and director of title Tender Loving Care, David Wheeler.
Hello, James.
So, David, as someone who's from the UK myself, I believe you've got some affection with it as well.
Well, yeah. I went to school in London, went to the London Film School. That was quite a while ago. It's still in the same place, I believe, on Shelton Street in Covent Garden. And still going strong, still a wonderful school, and they had a little reunion here in Hollywood last year, and it was quite fantastic to meet up with some of the old folks and some of the new folks, and spent some time speaking with Duncan Jones, who recently successful director from Moon and Source Code, and he's a recent graduate from the school. And then Michael Mann was there just before I was there. And Mike Lee, the wonderful Mike Lee, great British director, was one of my teachers.
Oh, now there's good name dropping for you. We've only just started the podcast.
Let's get it all over with. Because those are the only people I know.
No, you've just spoiled it. They're just going to switch off the podcast. So where are you both from, Rob? Let's start with you. Where are you from, sir?
Oh, I'm from Southern California.
And what about you, David?
Well, I am currently from Southern California. I live in Redondo Beach, which is South Bay, Los Angeles. But I'm from Toronto, Canada, originally.
So you've had a London film school background. What about you, Rob? How did you get into all this kind of career?
I have always been trying to make a living as an artist. But actually this particular path began when I first saw the Amiga 500. It was introduced, and I had actually, while it was in Southern California, I actually met the artist who developed the graphics for Defender of the Crown. It was published by CinemaWare. And we happened to go to the same users groups, the special interest Amiga users groups, down there, and we shared our files with each other and shared our work with the group. And so I got a recommendation from Jim Sachs, was the fellow's name. And if you look him up, he was one of the greatest, still is the greatest Amiga artist ever. he had been working on Defender of the Crown, but he had some difficulties with the publisher. I'm not sure exactly what they were, but he was offered the art directorship at CinemaWare, but he turned that down and recommended me instead. So, went in, got the interview, got the job, and the rest is history.
Ah. And have you got one of those crowning moments, David, where you can pick out that particular section of your life and you think, this is where it happened, this is where I went in this direction?
Yeah, as opposed to laying my eyes on an Amiga, I laid my eyes on Rob Landeros.
You lucky man.
Yes. I was living in Los Angeles, but had bought a home in Southern Oregon. It was a vacation home at first, and then after a couple of years, we decided to move up there. And I noticed a little ad in the local paper of the Southern Oregon, what was it called, Rob? The Cinema Society, something like that. The Southern Oregon Cinema Society. Anyway, the presenters at that particular monthly meeting was were Rob Landeros and Graham Devine presenting their video game, and the seventh guest. And so I just went to kind of meet people, and these guys started showing this video game, and it looked like a movie. It was so good. It was the seventh guest. It wasn't finished, and it was very, very cool. So I was intrigued, and a little bit later, we all got in touch with each other, and I was selected to direct the sequel, the 11th Hour, to the seventh guest. So I had nothing to do with the seventh guest at all, other than to just enjoy it. I was deeply involved in the 11th Hour long before the seventh guest was actually completed. Right, and I've been in the video game business pretty well ever since. That was 1993.
So, Rob, how did Trilobite Games come into being in the first place?
I, after my stint at CinemaWare, where I was vastly underappreciated, as it turns out, I found that out when I asked for a raise. I got word from a friend of mine who had been working at Virgin Games. I think it was called Virgin Mastertronic at that time. And they were just down the road a piece from where I was working at CinemaWare. They're located in Newport Beach, California. And so I went down there, interviewed, got that job. Where I met my would-be, soon-to-be partner, Graham Devine. He was head of programming there, and I became art director of that little company. And during that time, actually, I'd been hired on to increase their, they wanted to go to premium games. They'd been dealing with bargain bin basement products and doing very well at it, but they wanted to raise their level of graphics and games in general. At the same time, they kept slipping back into kind of some funky, uninteresting, silly products that I wasn't really interested in. And Graham, I think, was sort of bored with some of the games they were doing also. So Graham and I kind of shared an interest in not doing that and maybe doing something more interesting instead. And at that time, what was starting to make the scene was the whole idea of multimedia, video and music, and the coming CD-ROM technology, which hadn't really hit at that point. This was in like 89, 90. So that's what Graham and I took a shine to. And so we convinced our boss, Martin Elper, who was the president of Virgin, we convinced him to send us off and let us go to the various conventions, trade shows, in which all those which panels and people were making presentations and talking about the new technology, CD-ROM, and multimedia. And so that's what Graham and I did for, gosh, several months. We went to New York, Chicago, all this, yeah, all these conventions. And so at a certain point, we're just coming back from New York. We're sitting in LaGuardia Airport waiting for our flight, and me being a conscientious person, I thought, gee, we've been, you know, kind of having a good time on the company's dime, going to all these fun shows and goofing off. Maybe we should at least write a report about what we've discovered. And as we sat down to write the report, we started talking about, well, what do you do with this technology? What do you do with all the storage? And then we just literally, on the back of a napkin, we wrote down, jotted down some ideas for a game, which eventually came to be Seventh Guest. Actually, we took that, came home, I typed it up, our presentation, over the next couple of weeks, came in one morning and presented it to our boss in the morning about maybe 9:30. And about 10:30 or 11, he comes in and says, "Oh, I like this. So yeah, I approve. Let's go out to lunch and talk about it." So he took us out to lunch and said, "Yeah, we'll do it. We'll give you a contract." We were stunned, but we're happy, and that's kind of how that's that part of the story.
I must have been pretty brave at that time when CD-ROM was such a still quite an unknown quantity, and there you were, really pushing the limits of what was capable at the time. What was going through your head at that moment?
I'm not so sure. I think we're brave or stupid. because, and Martin also, Martin Alper, who decided to fund it to the tune of almost $500,000. So he was also brave or stupid. It all happened so fast. It was amazing. It was like I said, it happened all in the space of a morning and a lunch. The project was approved, and it was all agreed that we would not do the project there in-house, because I've learned that when there's a special project and special group working on it, there tend to be jealousies and suspicion and rivalries and all that stuff. So we thought it'd be best if we did it off-site, at least. Not only off-site, but that Graham and I leave the company, form our own company dedicated to doing the project. So that's, we decided, well, you know, where are we going to do this? Do we move down the street, do it in our house? No, we decided to move entirely out of the area up to Southern California in the middle of nowhere. Although I love being here in the middle of nowhere in Medford, Oregon. But at that time we thought, well, we've got this big contract. We'll probably be working for at least 2 years. Beyond that, who knows? So I guess we were confident. Again, it was crazy to actually move, pack up our wives and our TVs and all that other stuff that's important to us, and come up here to start this venture. If it had failed, well, Lord knows where we would be, but as it turned out okay. So, but yeah, I think at the same time, we were pretty excited and confident that we could do the job, and it turns out things fell into place. Technology came around at the right time, such as the 3D rendering software, which hardly anybody was using at that time, but you know, it happened to come along. You know, DeepPaint improved to Photoshop and things like that, and we saw, all of a sudden we had the tools that allowed us to do these things. And Graham had enough confidence in himself to be able to create a codec, a video codec that allowed this, you know, streaming, allowed streaming off a CD-ROM at a high rate, and then made it look good and made it work. So, yeah, we got lucky. The right place at the right time, the right idea.
And even though CDs was quite a new thing, you still managed to fill two of them.
That's right.
One just isn't enough for Rob.
We've got to make this a 2D game.
Yeah, why not? If we aren't pushing better. The boundaries enough, let's show we can do multiple discs.
And then DVD came along, but that's a different story.
Was that more than one disc as well?
Let's see. Probably.
Well, why not? Break barriers, that's what I like to hear. So, The Seventh Guest is really a dark game, isn't it? Staff is getting visions, and children are dying, and then there's the scary mansion, which includes lots of puzzles. Where did all this come from?
You know, really, most of it came from the mind of Matthew Costello. We had actually sketched out the basic idea, and Graham, in our original design, but Graham wrote a two-piece plot outline. And I don't know where he got the idea, but it was about the toy maker who made toys and the children and all that stuff. And that's what he sent to Matthew Costello. And what we got back was Henry Stoff and the magician, and Martine Burden, and all those characters. So, yeah, I hardly had anything to do with it, the story, or the direction of the movie, script, any of that stuff, really. And actually, neither did Graham. In those days, we considered ourselves, you know, geeks, software guys, you know, designers and whatnot, but not script writers or movie makers or anything like that. So let our approach was hands off, let those guys do what they do, and then we got what we got.
And apparently Bill Gates also said The Seventh Guest is the new standard in interactive entertainment.
How about that?
I know, that's not a bad credential, is it?
No. But, you know, again, he was pushing the technology. He was pushing multimedia. So, you know, it was kind of a natural for him to get behind our little project.
It seems a lot of things came all just at the right time for this to happen, didn't it?
Yeah. Like I said, right place at the right time. And, of course, I guess we were the two guys who were out there actually thinking about how to make this technology work and how to use a CD. I think, you know, the young people who don't remember those old days don't recall that, well, you know, storage was an issue.
A major issue.
A major issue. Yeah, most of the games we were doing were shipping off on, you know, a little floppy disk or two. When developers, and I had this discussion with developers at the time, how are you going to fill up all that space? How can you possibly fill up a CD's worth, you know, 600 megabytes with content? What do you do? I mean, if you can put video on it, but you can't play it off of it, so, you know. So that was, those are the questions, and you know, we just came up with the answers. Incredibly enough, the people were thinking there was too much storage is a mind-boggling thing to consider. that's what they were worried about. Not us. We're too stupid. I mean, too brave.
I'll say again, two CDs. That says it all, really.
Yep.
So, The 11th Hour was obviously the sequel to The Seventh Guest. The setting was still very dark, but the mansion had become a forgotten, dusty environment for the player to explore. So, what was the design thinking behind this? And obviously, David had involvement with this one.
Right. This was our 4CD endeavor.
You see? Here we go again.
Stop it, too. Yeah. I basically came in after Matthew had written the first script and worked on the script with him and set it up. It was a much bigger video production than The Seventh Guest. And The Seventh Guest was, everything was shot on blue screen, and the characters were composited into the scenes. Is that correct, Rob?
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas with The 11th Hour, we went with full-bore, live-action, on-location video shooting all over the valley in southern Oregon, and along with some blue screen stuff as well. But everything was a little more sophisticated and a little more expensive. I think we had double the budget that that was available for The Seventh Guest. And so from the production end of the story, it was a bigger production. We shot with higher end cameras, and we actually had real blue screen. I think the original stuff was shot upstairs in a restaurant against some blue butcher paper.
But whatever works.
That's right. And the actual difficult resolution with the Seventh Guest, I think, worked to its advantage because the characters looked much more ghostly because they were so ill-defined.
And that's another example of serendipity and good fortune, that we happen to be dealing with ghosts and bad technology.
So how difficult was it to follow a success like the Seventh Guest? Obviously, there was going to be a lot more pressure, especially if your budget was doubled. You now coveted 4 CDs. I mean, how did you go into that project, and how did you find the reception after it was completed?
You're right. It's always difficult to do a successful follow-up, and I think we would have done well to just duplicate what we had done our efforts on Seventh Guest and make it very, well, pretty much the same, extend the characters of the story a little bit, and do it in the same fashion, the same gameplay. But, you know, that's a little boring. I never like to repeat myself too much, but I still like to explore the same theme and maybe take a slight path, and that's what I tried to do with 11th Hour. So, you know, we moved it into the present day. We introduced some technology into it with his little game book that the protagonist used to, you know, discover what's going on. He had a helpmate, an ally in Samantha, the good female in the story, who helped him maneuver his way through the house and find his ex-girlfriend, Robin Morales, his ex-girlfriend and producer. We moved the game to more modern day, the dilapidated mansion. We changed the graphics. So I didn't want to feel like moving around the same old house over again. So there were those kinds of deviations from the first one. Plus, as David said, it was, you know, we wanted to expand the story, get a little more sophisticated in the storytelling. I mean, when I look back at the Seventh Guest, I do recognize that the drama was corny and melodramatic at best. It's not exactly what I had envisioned originally, but, you know, it's what it was. And it was okay. It was fun. But David and Matthew brought a little more humanity to it and actual real people and real motivations and personalities that were not just two-dimensional. So we fleshed that out, and I was happy with that. Thank you, David.
Yeah, and with our desire for expansion, we doubled the corn and doubled the melodrama. It was terrific.
Yeah, we need that extra CD for all the extra corn.
Yeah.
No. That's corn. Let's just, you know, express that a little bit clearer. Corn.
Oh, yes. Corn with a C.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. I mean, for me, I wasn't a part of the first project at all, and as I mentioned before, and so, you know, there was no particular pressure. In fact, this was just a very small budget thing. I had just come off a TV show, which our budget was in the tens of millions, and it was. but I've always felt that. That it doesn't matter how much money you have, whether you have, you know, half a million, a million, or 10 million, you never have enough money. And so you do it with whatever you have. And we didn't have a very big budget for the film shoot, and we still made the most of it. I think we got a lot of production value, a lot of quality. And what was interesting is, of course, I haven't worked with any of the actors or any of the other creative people from The Seventh Guest. And as it turned out, they were all really, really good, really good. And and not least of all, Fat Man. He's a really, really talented musician and composer, and I really admire him. And every now and then, I'll put on, you know, the music There's a combined CD with the music from both, although it's not CD anymore. It's now on my iTunes, and I'm astonished at how good it actually is. It's really very, very good. But anyway, yeah, so we started off by shooting the movie, and one of the things, I had never made a game before. I had no idea. I hardly even ever played a game before. But for the movie part of it, it didn't matter because it wasn't that sort of, the movie was not the game. The movie was just the story. But interestingly enough, I was thinking about this morning. In the original script, the protagonist was getting messages from his missing girlfriend via they were tape messages. They would arrive audio tape, and I was just thinking about that. I thought, you know, we could do something a little more hip than that. And I had this little flip open calculator sort of thing that had a screen on it, but it was a screen just for, you know, for to calculate your numbers on, and I think you could maybe, it was a contact thing too, you could enter contacts. This is before, long before the days of video phones and anything like that. We did have cell phones in those days, but they were just flip phones. They were with absolutely no video screens at all.
They made calls.
Yes, they made calls.
And that was it.
They dropped a lot of calls most of the time.
They still do.
Yeah, that part hasn't improved much.
Mean I can make calls with my iPhone?
Rob hinting that he's using Skype on iPhone, just in case you didn't get that subtle.
So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if you could see some video on in this message instead of just hearing the audio? So we took this little flip calculator that cost about, I don't know, $20 or something, and turned that into a device which he received, in the, which Carl received in the mail, and opened it up, and there's video playing of his missing girlfriend and stuff like that. And we used it throughout, and it turned out that it was basically, Rob used it as the interface for the game, or as a main interface for the game. Which is really kind of funny because I was partly responsible for creating the interface in a game, and I didn't even know what an interface was. The word was strange to me. It was just an accident.
And it also served, as I recall, as a device in which you could play the video at a smaller screen size, so it didn't have to be full screen. So you could have the full motion, you know, video. It wouldn't need to be compressed.
It wouldn't need to be six CDs.
Missed our opportunity.
But by that time, you know, it just didn't matter how many CDs we had because the technology was such that the video was what it was. It was pretty damn good and better than anything else that was out there. But the streaming video was definitely staccato to some degree.
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the reasons 11th Hour is late. And Graham blames David and I for going off and shooting stuff with full full video with the real life backgrounds and all that stuff that didn't compress very well. So that took Graham a while to be able to figure out how to to play that kind of video, because some guests, of course, the background is totally static. So.
Yeah, but there was some confusion there, and I think, Graham was not happy with the way that I did, because I had we had flying down the highway, shooting guy on a motorcycle and stuff like that. But we had a little discussion about not moving the camera, but I thought it was only referring to the blue screen stuff because it would be so difficult to adjust the backgrounds for the. Blue screen. Nowadays, of course, you can do that, but and so I didn't move the camera during the blue screen stuff. It sat there in one spot for the 3 or 4 days we were shooting blue screen. But wow. I didn't know that we were limiting everything to that.
That was so. Excellent non-camera movement work on your part, David.
Yes. Well, it was pretty damn hard, I'll tell you, because you put this. You have one little square screen, and a camera pointing at it. But we were doing regular complicated scenes in which you had, you know, reverse angles and dialogue and all that kind of stuff. And so having to, and we really didn't have the backgrounds prepared. So every shot we'd have to kind of rotate in my head to try and figure out where the hell should these people be standing to look like they're in the opposite. So it was not easy. So that was great non-movement camera work. It was some of my finest.
It's all about the angles.
That's right. He's working the angles. By the way, that is something I hadn't thought about. I haven't heard too many people actually appreciate the fact that we were not only was it just full, you know, out on location video and so on, but the stuff that was blue screen composited did have, you know, did use more cinematic techniques of the over the shoulders, the reverse angles on the characters and so on, cutting back and forth, which Seventh Guest and other games didn't have in those days. So,
and actually most movies didn't have in those days. Most movies, when they did the process shots, were just a single angle, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was because it is tricky to figure out where to go.
And I suppose you had to be very careful as well. In one aspect, you want to be very careful and tell the story and immerse the player in all of that background information, but not forgetting it's a game and it needs to have interaction within it all as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, much of that was, Matthew had more experience with that, so the story was pretty interactive with the game. But at that point, we couldn't really interact with the video itself. It's still a very demanding process.
I tried to tie the gameplay in with the video, just not in any integral way at all, but just a reference. So if you were exploring the mansion and the clues and puzzles and games would lead you. It was a treasure hunt, so it would lead you from one object to the other, to one discovery to the other, and often the objects that and the clues that were involved in the interactive portion of the game would be tied in with perhaps the next scene that was coming up in the drama portion. So if you were looking for a razor blade or a knife or something like that, the next scene might be, you know, Julia Heine wielding her own blade and knife at poor Chuck, mm-hmm. Chucky, who can toss him into the soup.
Chuck him into the
Chuck,
soup.
Chuck steak soup.
As you do. So, I've just been having a little look at Wikipedia and what that says about the 11th hour. And under the development section, and granted, Wikipedia isn't always 100%, but I thought I'd ask this. Seeing as we mentioned Korn, the makers of the game originally intended it to contain more adult content in its cutscenes. The script for the game, published as part of a walkthrough guide, included several R-rated sex scenes. So is this actually true?
I don't remember. It's all blank.
Yeah, you sound like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I was just going to say he sounds very much like a politician there.
Yeah. You know, we were pushing the boundaries quite a bit there.
I'm just thinking of poor David and his angles as much as anything.
we did have alt scenes that were more adult. But, you know, it was a difficult time because games, and even today, games are still considered somehow for children. And even though you could put labels on them as we do today with that it's not recommended for children, you know, they still get a hold of them. So there was a lot of controversy during those days about having any kind of, quote, adult content in a game. Although violence doesn't seem to be adult content, blood and guts is okay. So it was controversial. It was controversial within the company as well. We had a lot of discussions about it and where to go and what to do with it and so on.
David,
yes.
Did we ever shoot any nudity?
Yes.
Okay. So we have the footage, and that is that is true. But as so many films, you shoot a lot of stuff that you never use. So, and it never made it into the game. So what's the big deal? Ah. And it was a big deal for a controversy without a controversy.
Now, you see, that's very good of you, Rob, because according to Wikipedia, and it may have saved you a few blushes, so somebody's no doubt going to update it when they hear this podcast and reference to it. Rumours immediately surfaced that an uncut version of the 11th Hour existed, leading to the game makers announcing that the R-rated sequences, though planned, were never filmed.
Ah. Well, maybe Rob and Graham didn't know that I actually filmed. Or that when all those hordes of naked people were running in front of the camera was actually running.
And now we know why they call it blue screen.
And, there you go. Unfortunately, we shoot green screen these days. So.
Oh, dear.
One more blue.
But yeah, that was, I think it was one scene, wasn't it, Dave? One?
More than one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, but not a whole lot more than one.
Yeah.
You're just trying to make David blush now.
No, I have no qualms about it at all. It was just it wasn't like it was X-rated or pornographic in any way.
Suggestive.
It was just there were images that were controversial sorts of things that that we had decided upon, and we because we weren't sure about the usability, we shot alternate stuff, and the alternate stuff is what ended in the game. It wasn't like there was a whole lot of it.
It was mostly Marie, the bad girl. She was Stoff's spawn of Stoff. She was wicked. She was a seductress. She, tempted you with some images of, S&M bondage stuff. She was wearing black, garb and a whip or something like that, So it was part of the theme. She was the wicked, evil girl, and she was one who was she was a temptress. So it wasn't just superfluous to the story.
No, it wasn't at all. It was, in fact, the stuff that we used, without any nudity, less. What's the word here? Less directly connected to the story than had we gone with the nudity.
So, a slightly different direction was taken with the title called Clandestiny. It had a similar Seventh Guest feel, but with cell animation that made it feel like an interactive cartoon with spooky quests. So, was this meant to appeal to a different, younger audience than what Trilobite had become used to?
I was only tangentially involved in Clandestiny. That was actually...
I was a little more involved in it.
Oh, but right.
By the time Clandestine was being made, I was now an employee. When I first worked on The 11th Hour, it was just a contractual thing. I just worked on it for a few months. Subsequently, I joined Trilobite as the sort of resident filmmaker, and I was fairly involved with the development of the story and the animation and all that stuff, quite involved with it. And yes, it was definitely designed for a younger audience, and in fact we got some writers who were very well known children's book writers who lived in Ashland, Oregon, which is where we were, and so they wrote script, and I worked with them on the script, and then we got a very good animator, and who actually lived locally, and with a lot of Hollywood experience, and yeah, so, but definitely it was designed that way, meaning designed towards a younger audience, no question.
And do you think it succeeded? Did it attract that audience you're after, or was it more of the case of the 7th Guest and 11th Hour people wanting to try something else, Trilobite?
Well, if only we'd left all the nudity in the it would have been a huge hit.
The first nude children's cartoon game.
Could be very educational, I'm sure.
Yes, it would have sold.
Sure.
In Europe, it would have done well.
So a title that has just been released on iOS is Tender Loving Care, featuring prominent actor John Hurt, no less. Now, this is a real psychological undertaking, as the player is asked all kinds of personal questions, but why was this approach taken? Because even though The 7th Guest and The 11th Hour were dark, this one really is more psychological and pushing you into all different areas of the mind and trying to analyse what is happening in front of you.
What originally happened with this is there was a book that I discovered called Tender Loving Care, written by Andrew Niederman, and I really fell in love with the book. I liked it very, very much, and so the entire story and everything was based on that book, and a book, psychological thriller, and so we started from that point of view that it is a psychological thriller. And we took that to quite a severe degree, that it was, in fact, very psychological. And we ended up working with, the psych department at the university and all kinds of things about this. And it was kind of interesting because on one of our sojourns out to creative Rob and I were sitting talking, and I had this idea like, well, we're still thinking of 11th Hour and 7th Guest. Like, I think that maybe we could come up with a lot of psychological puzzles, Rorschach tests and things like that, that we could somehow interpret into a game. And Rob kind of shocked me. He said, how about if we have no puzzles? And this is the puzzle meister who's saying this to me. The person who had created all the puzzles for The 7th Guest and The 11th Hour and, was a puzzle aficionado.
And no gameplay either.
Yes. Well, eventually, no gameplay. No gameplay. Well, that's not true.
I think know.
It's highly interactive and there's plenty of gameplay. It's just you don't get to shoot anybody.
there's no puzzles. Oh, well, go ahead. Yeah, people do refer to it as a game almost exclusively, which has rather surprised me. They compare it to other games, our fans do, to Riven or whatever. So I will not argue with that.
Yeah. We had quite a fabulous beginning to this whole thing. Rob and I both rode motorcycles in those days, and we had the script which I had written for Tender Loving Care, and we were trying to decide what to do with it. And it was written as a full-blown sort of movie script. And so we took off on our bikes, went down to the coast in Oregon, and spent a few days, and basically came up with the complete concept for this project, and it was a really fruitful endeavor. We really were away from the office, away from everything, away from our family responsibilities and all that stuff, and we really did do almost nothing but work for those days, and it was a great experience. And as Rob just referred to, that there was no gameplay. And in fact, there is gameplay, but there are no wrong choices. And you don't have to memorize or learn or repeat anything. and you simply respond, react.
And it's not goal-oriented.
Right. And we came up with this idea. We were kind of like batting around different ideas. And one of the things, one of my favorite writers is Aldous Huxley. And we were talking about in Brave New World, there was this cinematic experience where people would go to the feelies, they were called, and as opposed to the movies, and they sat in their seats, which were connected somehow to their biorhythm, and as they watched what was happening on the screen, the sensors in the seats could interpret how they were feeling as a mass audience, or the majority, and the movie would change in response to them. So, in other words, it's a biofeedback kind of rendition of the story. And we thought, wouldn't that be cool? Could we tell people a story and have them react to it in some biofeedback way, and the story would change as the ultimate interactive movie with the way that they were reacting to the story? And that was, that thought was, I would say, the backbone of Tender Loving Care, of how it works, how it was developed, what we did with it, and why we did it.
Right. That's the underlying concept.
And how did you get John Hurt involved? Because he's obviously quite a big name.
Yeah. He's a wonderful actor. We had a little more money for the video than we did in the 11th hour. Not a whole lot more, but we, you know, went with our usual method of casting. We didn't have stars, basically. We decided that there was this pivotal role. The most important role in the whole thing, not the most important role in the movie part of it, but in the, forgive me, Rob, game part of it. So we started talking with major agencies, and that came out of William Morris agency in New York. They suggested some people, and when I saw John Hurt's name in the suggestions, I went, oh my God. Because, you know, this was in the mid-90s, and Elephant Man was just a couple of years old at that point, and that was one of the greatest performances that has ever been done in cinema. And he was available during the time. We didn't put a lot of pressure on him that we didn't need him for the entire shoot. We could compact everything into several days. We shot for 31 days on that show, and I think John Hurt was with us for maybe a week, I think. And then he did. There was, of course, his voice is used throughout the entire interactive process. And he was shooting. I think he was shooting Love and Death in Long Island. I'm not sure. I think that was the movie. Another great movie, great performance. And they were shooting up in Halifax, Canada. And we did much of the voice stuff over, telephone connections and, direction and stuff from Oregon to Halifax. And it was really cool. Did many hours of that.
And I suppose the role was very important for the fact is having to have a connection with the player is looking directly at camera and has to communicate with the player.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
He's the guide. He's the guide who. He's your interface contact guy. Who involves you directly. He, you know, pulls you into the story, gets you involved. At the same time, he's the psychiatrist who is measuring your responses and determining who you are and what you know, and creating a personality profile of you during the whole process. And yeah, it's this idea of getting back to what Dave was talking about earlier in terms of this theoretical movie with the biofeedback mechanism that adapts itself to the audience. Have you never noticed when you go to a movie with a friend or a few friends that you walk out of the theater and as you discuss it, sometimes the reaction is so differs from yours so much that you often wonder, did we just watch the same movie?
Yeah.
Is that what you got out of it? I think it was that what you were thinking? You thought that character was, unsympathetic or bad or something. And since that happens anyway, we decided to make a movie that you know, is different for everybody. And it has to do with your psychology, your personality. And that was another little hook that we thought would be very important and interesting for players is to, throughout the game, you can go to your personality profile section and read the notes that Dr. Turner has been jotting down, making about you according to how you responded to both the exit polls, which we call, and the thematic apperception tests. Those are the two feedback mechanisms that we employ. So after watching a bit of drama, you were led directly by Turner. He comes out and makes the comments. It's just kind of cool, I think, about what he has just seen. Sometimes he's shocked and amazed. And, you know, I can't believe what's going on in this house, these people. I never expected this. So what do you think? And then so we call them exit polls because that's, people who are doing focus group testing movies often have those. So they fill out the card. They're polling the audience about what they've just seen, the characters, and how they're feeling about things. And then you can interact with the environment in which the movie's been taking place. That was another nice thing about the script, is that it was very contained within just a couple of locations. Either the Overton family house, or the Dr. Turner's office. So everything is contained. You can explore around. During that interactive exploration, the game portion, I guess you might call it, that was all voluntary. You could either do that or ignore it, skip that entire thing. But if you wanted to get the full measure of value, entertainment, and content, you would spend some time looking around, poking around. You could poke around in the characters' diaries. You can see what phone calls they had just made recently by hitting redial on the phone, what radio they had been listening to by turning on the radio, and so on. And, it puts an extra spin.
It sounds, a little bit pretentious that a game is psychoanalyzing the player, but it actually is. And was. And what happened was we wrote all of these questions that had to do with the with the film that you had just seen, the piece of story, and then also, as Rob mentioned, the thematic apperception test, which is a standard a psychological test in which you look at an image and you respond to the image. And to each of these images or questions, we supplied several answers, and you just choose one of those answers. But the answers were actually, every answer was examined by psychology students and psychology professors as to what they would reveal about a personality. And, we took there are supposedly eight basic traits of any human personality and their opposite. So there are 16 places, and we kind of created a bar graph, and every answer that you selected fit somewhere along that graph. And sometimes in two or three places, sometimes just in one. But it was always tied. Every answer was tied to something, which was a real psychological test. And so the profile that was being created was actually a real profile and a real psychological test in actually a very sophisticated way. And as Rob said earlier, the Dr. Turner often gave you feedback on your profile, and many of the fans of Tender Loving Care would say things like, "I can't believe how accurate this is. This just sounds like me." And it wasn't a gimmick. It actually was working.
Yeah, and plus we threw in some, the product is a little satirical in terms of, psychiatry and pop psychology and a new agey kind of stuff. So when you read Dr. Turner's profiles, he has recommendations also. He analyzes he does a quick, brief analysis of you, and then he makes a recommendation, such as should do yogic breathing and drink chamomile tea, as a recommendation for whatever is wrong with you. So there's a lot of that. In fact, there's a lot of that in the interactive stuff. When you explore the house, the environment, we're poking a lot of fun at the new agey stuff, and so that's a lot of fun. But more importantly, I think what you find in the house is you discover what the characters are recording in their diaries or in their tape machines, what their observations are, what their past history is. They often recall instances from the past and so on. You get a more fully fleshed multidimensional outlook on these people that are inhabiting this world. So it's more introducing the elements of that you might find in a book or a novel into a movie.
So because of the psychological twist, and it sounds from what you're describing incredibly intelligent in its working out of who you are as a person and giving you a response, did it make it a much harder production compared to previous titles you'd worked on?
Depends on the point of view on that, yeah. Really.
Did you learn something about yourselves you didn't know before?
We learned that we like it, that we want to do another project.
I like this particular product. I am really proud of it. I'm proud of a lot of stuff I've done. I'm happy with the success from the Seventh Guest. But in Tender Loving Care, I think I realized something about where my interests lie and what I would like to see happen with the advancement of media and storytelling and how those two are involved. And that goes way back, when I think about it, to my early days with CinemaWare, which was one of those software companies that tried to introduce cinematic storytelling techniques into gameplay by using establishing shots, for instance, introducing a romantic element into this, as a background, actually bringing back story to the fore. So there was that, and of course, Seventh Guest was, that was definitely wanting to introduce a story, an interactive story into games. And with TLC, it's really an extension of that without so much emphasis on problem solving, making it more accessible. So it really tried to enhance and develop and basic story and characters, something that is totally ignored in the gaming world. They're not into character and character-driven plots and stories and adventures. So, that's kind of what I learned about myself, or the direction I would like to go. And plan to go, intend to go in the future.
So inevitably, we come on to the all-important question, which I'm sure a lot of listeners will be eager to know. There was talk quite a while ago of the Seventh Guest Part 3. Is there any chance of this still becoming a reality?
Oh, that's why I'm here. That's not here on this podcast, but...
Oh, that's a shame.
Yes, I'm hoping this will be a stepping stone, James, to greater, bigger things.
Absolutely.
Because I dropped out of the gaming world for quite a time there, after my stint at Trilobite and then at David and my company, Aftermath. By the way, at Aftermath, that's where we finished up Tender Loving Care, and then we actually did another one called Point of View, which was along the same lines, less ambitious, but it's out there. And I'll just gloss over that for the moment, just to make the point that at that point, again, late 90s, I decided to, I'd had it up to my ears with the game stuff, and I didn't like what was being produced out there, and, you know, the shoot 'em up stuff for adolescent boys with all the violence and pointless activity, which I thought was totally non-redeeming qualities. You know, I saw nothing redeeming about what was being produced. And plus, it was if you weren't a big player, you were just out of it. You needed several million dollars to get, you know, stake in doing something in that environment. So I went back to my roots and of graphic design and did that for quite a while. So it wasn't actually until I got my iPhone and was amazed at the touch screen technology that I thought, this is great stuff. Not only is the technology there, but the market had opened up to where casual gaming was something that was a legitimate thing that a lot of people were doing. It was acceptable. Wasn't anything to look down upon. So I thought, well, you know, with casual gaming, I can do puzzles, I can do stuff. I should bring the seventh guest to this platform because of the ease of use, the touching, pointing, it's, you know, it's the equivalent of pointing and clicking. One of those things that I think I'm most proud of in having designed some guests is the ease of the interface. And this was kind of an enhanced extension of that philosophy. So, yeah, so I came back into this with the thought of not only reintroducing the seventh guest in 11th hour to the public again via touchscreens, iPads, and so on, but in the hopes, James, in the hopes of doing seventh guest part 3.
Ah.
David and I had begun work on what was called Seventh Guest Part 3, and that was intended to be a Seventh Guest Part 3, and it was entitled The Collector, which many fans mistook for the actual Seventh Guest Part 3. It was actually kind of an exploratory design and product that never got off the ground, one which... I didn't have any total creative control over, so it was more of a design by committee kind of thing. It had a lot of good ideas, but it really kind of was a tangent spin-off kind of thing and was not really the direct descendant of the franchise. So there was that. I just kind of wanted to dispel that rumor. The collector is Seventh Guest Part 3. I do have ideas for Seventh Guest Part 3, and as I indicated earlier, I'm going to take what I've learned and follow that direction, I think, on that path that I've come through from CinemaWare and Seventh Guest 11th Hour through Tender Loving Care. Try to put it all together into something really good.
So just to confirm then for the listeners, when we're talking about these touchscreen devices, it's not just about bringing back the classic titles you've worked on in the past. There is the possibility of absolutely brand new content coming out in the future. We just don't know what that exactly will be at the moment.
Yeah, that is my goal. That is my, well, That's the big enchilada I'm shooting for at this point. And everything I'm doing right now is in preparation for that. How it's going to come about, I don't know.
But that's half the fun, isn't it? It's how it progresses.
Sure.
You'll just agree with me.
Sure, whatever you say.
It's a breeze.
Well, you know, it's all part of the process. I saw that somebody posted something on Facebook. It was a chart of how people think success is, and it was kind of this arrow that's kind of going straight up to the, you know, from the bottom to the top, to the right. He says, but how success actually is achieved. And it's a line that starts off at the bottom left and it's kind of squiggles and goes all around and loop de loops and then comes that kind of comes out at the top there. So, yeah.
Rob, I think you should get on a motorcycle and go out to the coast of Oregon and figure this whole thing out.
Well, you know, Dave, I've kind of figured out a lot, actually. And I don't know, I should discuss with you more in detail. What's the difficult part is how it's going to be made. Who is going to fund the darn thing, right?
Kickstarter.
Yeah, theoretically.
I mean, sure. Anything's possible. There's lots of games being funded that way. In particular, another type of point-and-click adventure, Broken Sword, the fifth one, has been funded and raised over $700,000. So you never know.
You never know. Well, no, that is definitely up there on the list of probable ways to fund it. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I could tomorrow start a Kickstarter campaign. I'm ready to go in terms of ideas. But we'll see. Not sure I'm quite ready to walk off that plank.
It sounds like a motorbike visit is in order then, David.
Could be, yeah. I mean, Rob and I haven't worked together for quite a while. Several years. I guess since we did the, other than, of course, you know, we put our heads together on the iOS version of Tender Loving Care just recently, and we've reconnected and it's been great. But back in the days when we created the prototype for the collector, when I was living in Vancouver, we kind of went in separate directions. I moved off to Nashville, Tennessee for several years, and then I'm back here in Los Angeles and doing different things. But yeah, I would love to see a Seventh Guest Part 3. So get on with it, Rob.
Yeah. I don't have a motorcycle anymore.
Oh, no. Kickstarter one, motorcycle. Okay, we've got this.
Yes, I'll crowdsource my motorcycle purchase.
Well, you know how those old motorcycles used to be Kickstarters anyway.
They didn't exactly.
Oh, that's right. Hey.
You see, it's all coming together, just like the seventh guest.
Oh. It's all coming together.
It's an omen.
See, this is how the process works.
And it's just all because you came onto my podcast, you see.
Exactly.
Well, thanks, guys, ever so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm sure we'll all keep our fingers crossed that you two do come together again and make a beautiful sequel in the terms of The Seventh Guest. And who knows where that may lead.
Thank you, James. It'll lead to another podcast, won't it?
Well, if you're going to make an announcement like a new game, absolutely. You get on your motorbike and pop round and we'll sort it out.
All right. Thanks very much, James. It was nice speaking with you. And good to hear your voice, Rob.
Ah, you too, David.
And whoever's voice that is.
are you hearing a dog?
Yes.
Doggone it.
I thought that was your stomach growling.
Oh, well. At least you waited this long to start crying.
Well,
all right. Thank you very much, James.
Thanks again, guys.